Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us on Unlimited Realities Radio. I am your host, Lisa Zimmer Mahoney, and today we will be speaking with my guest, best-selling author Kevin Tuohy, author of The Miracle of Optimism. Kevin is a motivation and inspirational life coach. He has been considered an underdog for most of his life, having grown up in poverty, attending six different grammar schools by the time he was in the fifth grade, and lived in eight different homes by the time he was 10. Kevin is now Hall of Fame college basketball coach, inspirational workshop facilitator, motivational speaker and life coach, author of The Miracle of Optimism, Kevin Tuohy. Kevin, thank you so much for being on Unlimited Realities Radio.
Well, thank you, Lisa, very much, and you know what a great title to your show, Unlimited Realities. I love that.
Oh, thank you, thank you. It was inspired many years ago.
We do. Wow, that's great. Unlimited Realities, yes.
Unlimited Realities. It actually started out as a television show, so now it's my radio show. So we're moving on.
Oh, okay. Oh, good.
Now, Kevin,
good.
Yeah, it's always onward and upward, right? I loved your book, Kevin, The Miracle of Optimism. What a wonderful book. Miracles and optimism, two of my favorite topics. You not only provide a heartfelt story, but you also provide a workbook within the book to help the reader identify a lot of personal blocks and be able to move through them. Can you tell us, you've inspired so many people with this book, including me. Could you tell us a little bit about your experiences that brought about the pivotal moment that birthed this book, The Miracle of Optimism?
Sure, yes. I read a lot of stories, inspirational stories about people, how they've overcome obstacles in their life and how they've moved forward, and, you know, always felt very inspired by those. And then I saw, you know, I would see a lot of self-help workbooks out there which are also wonderful and worked through many of them myself, and they were very helpful to me. And so what I thought to myself is that, you know, if these books were very helpful to me, my story is not unique. There's other people who've had it harder in life than me as a young child. There's other people that maybe had it easier, relatively speaking. And so I thought if I took stories that were, you know, some that could be considered harsh or tough life circumstances, and then if I could take kind of how I looked at it back then and also how I looked at it as I moved through my life through an optimistic lens, and then took the book and said, okay, now, reader, here's a chance for you to kind of plug in your own stories, because at the end of each chapter I put, well, what's your story, so that the book wouldn't just be about my stories. And then here's some questions that over the years I've asked myself, and in 20 years of being a life coach, asked my clients to help them move out of the condition and circumstances in their life into not thinking that they were restricted by those. That once you identify those and actually see them on paper, and then have some exercises or tools, I don't leave people hanging there, some exercises or tools to transform them into something different so people's lives became more powerful, you know, I thought that could be a pretty good book. You know, I thought that would be something that would be helpful and people would be able to use it to end up telling their story. And that's been kind of the cool thing, is many people have said to me, wow, this book became my book as I did the exercises. So that's really how conceptually the idea came about.
Right. Well, it is a very moving, inspiring book, and actually inspired me to get this radio show going. So that's why I wanted you on as my first guest, because you did inspire me. This was actually an inception of back in April 1st, ironically April Fool's Day. And I sat on it because one thing after another presented itself, and I thought, well, you know, it's not time. Well, after reading your book, it was time. And so it was very important for me to have the man of the miracle of optimism on first. And so you're welcome. I mean, it was really, it's an inspiring book, and yet at the same point, you do write about some really harsh experiences that you went through in childhood, which, you know, part of the writing has a lot of emotional pieces in it. And did you find like one part of the book that was a little bit more difficult to write than others to get through it,
yeah,
or that you kind of went through a metamorphosis in your own in writing it?
Absolutely, and that's also part of the reason, you know, one writes. Let me address that question, but, you know, first responding to, like, using the book and then moving off the snide, if you will, to get this show going. See, people often wonder, you know, why they're not passionate or, you know, what their direction in life is. And one of the things I wanted to do with the book is show people that if you have all these if you have all this negativity on top of it, if you become a victim of your circumstances, and if you become a victim of your situations or conditions in your life, meaning that it paralyzes you, then you're going to have trouble tapping into your passions. So part of the book, and then I'll answer your other question, part of the book, part of the reasoning for the book was to say, hey, here's how you can uncover your passion. Here's how you can move forward. Because if this stuff, like if my childhood, you know, was on top of it, and I didn't look at it for the optimism or the miracles that happened in my life as a result of those things, then I wouldn't be on this radio show. I wouldn't have written a second book, and I wouldn't do what I do for a living. So for me, writing the book was quite incredible because you think you've healed things and you think that you've, you know, moved forward. And some of that is intellectual. And what writing the book did for me is really move the healing into my heart. And, yeah, I think that, you know, the forgiveness chapter, so many people in so many settings that I've spoken in, because I do speak for a living, you know, have raised their hand either during the meeting or during the speech or emailed me afterwards. I haven't talked to my father in 10 years. I had a woman that pulled in front of my house when I was mowing the lawn who didn't really know me but wanted to give me a hug, recognize me, that she had not had a relationship with her sister. And if it wasn't for the chapter on forgiveness that I wrote on my dad and had actually the practical nature of forgiveness, you know, then she never would have had this relationship. That chapter was interesting for me because for many, many years before I started writing the book, I kind of, you know, had it in my mind. And this is what I mean about intellectualizing versus the heart, that my father blew on his deathbed when he was dying and he called for me. Of all the siblings, he called for me to come in and hold his hand and be with him. And, you know, he wanted it to go a certain way and he wanted silence. And he's the one that was really in spirit and he was the one that was as close to God, I think, as a human can get before they pass to the other side. And I wanted to orchestrate the forgiveness. I'm the one who wanted to receive the sorry. And I'm the one who wanted him to say, you know, that I love you beyond condition, sorry I beat you up, or all the other things that happened. And I missed my chance. And when I wrote that chapter, I'll never forget it, I was down in front of the fireplace, and my wife came down, and I was crying very hard, and I read the chapter to her, and she cried very hard because it was my first connection with the fact that I was the one that was in my ego, that I was the one that really needed to forgive myself. And then I just started writing about self, and I'm not the first one that's written about self-forgiveness being the most important, but the story, I think, is gut-wrenching in a way that I hold up the mirror and say to myself, oh my God, who am I to judge my father for anything? And I know that people reading the book will say, well, you know, no one should hit a child with a paint can. No one should break a child's nose. I understand all that, and that is very, very true. But what his death scene provided me with was, wait a minute, as a result maybe of some of those beatings, I adopted some crappy behaviors myself. I had some places that I was out of integrity. Whoa, wait a minute. Now maybe let me work on forgiving myself for those. And then I wrote a couple exercises to do that. Once I got to that, I healed. I realized that my father was just divinely, spirited and connected to God in that moment. And what he was orchestrating, I had my ego in the way of. And he was orchestrating a healing without words. It was incredible. And so that one was, wow. That was a really, yeah. And it was really cool to write that. I think that the chapter that I think inspires so many people, the story that, and it really is a bedrock, I think, of my persistence in my life today and my my leadership and my gratefulness. The things, Lisa, that keep people like us doing what we do is the scene of going to beg for food right after the Kennedy inauguration. Any of us that are old enough remember how cold that was. and snowy, yeah. And my brothers and I had to go out and ask for food, and didn't get it. Kind of connected me with the idea that we don't always get, in spite of our effort, in spite of what we put into it, we have to be in a spot to realize that we don't always get what we want, and then there's a lesson in that. And
right.
For me, creativity
right.
came out of that, and yeah. So those two chapters. Of course, my sister, seeing her spirit after she passed away, and not connecting with that really for so many years. Been embarrassed to tell people I saw her, embarrassed that I saw a light around her. The miracle of it is I didn't go to the funeral, but I described to my sister finally, and this is while writing the book, I finally called her and said, this is what I saw Regina wear. And my sister told me that's what she was buried in, and she had never worn it before. And so I think
that's divine intervention there.
Yes.
Yeah, that would be, you know, there was so many things in your book that really pulled my heart out, and my empathy, my compassion was just so ignited for you. Having to ask for food and going to bed hungry, having that moment with your sister of where she fell asleep on
yeah.
your lap, and that real
yes.
bond that
yes.
the two of you had, and also losing your sister to leukemia. I mean, that's something that's a harsh reality that, no parent should ever have to bury a child, and no one should have, that's a heart-wrenching, trauma. And for your entire family to have to go through that, and your parents, and that's bound to change a parent. That's bound to change your father, in fact. And so,
yeah.
Some people are natural optimists. I mean, you and I have talked about this where, we tend to look at everything, like the glass is half full. But it's surprising to me how optimism is actually something that can actually be taught or may need to be taught to some people, because pessimism, especially when we have a failing economy, it's easy for others to kind of go into that negative pessimistic mode of thought and mentality.
Yes.
Can you give us some tools or just some basic,
sure.
simple, reflections or thoughts or tools that you can share with our audience in regard to how to increase our optimism, or to even just to tap into optimism if we're just so stuck
sure.
in being a pessimist?
Okay. Well, first, the tool of what not to do, and that is to not wait for your condition or circumstance to change for you to become optimistic. That's what most people do, and really that's a very profound choice, because it starts with a choice. And I'll tell you how my rituals started when I was very, very young, very young. And I believe that this is the key to how I came out of that optimistically, as opposed to some of my siblings. All right, so that's the first choice. The first choice is that you're not going to depend on something changing so that you can be happy and optimistic, that you're going to be that first. And then when rough times come, if you're an optimist and you're really happy at your core, and I'm going to get to how to make that happen if you're not that right now, if that's not at your core right now, then even when something good happens, really it's going to be very, very tough for you to maintain long-term joy and happiness. So that's important. And if conditions don't go your way and you're not optimistic and happy, you're just going to use it as proof that things just never go your way. And things aren't good, and why should I be happy? So that's it. It takes rituals. Really, mm-hmm. I believe that any ongoing behavioral or habit has to be changed by rituals. And it can't be done from the neck up. And so as a little boy, mm-hmm. I didn't know I was doing this. And then as I got trained in psychophysiology, as I got trained in the science of mind, as I started, I've studied with many mentors, Dr. Yu Len. I got it, that, wow, I did this. And here's how it went for me, and then I'll tell you what I do as an adult. And
okay.
I want to make sure I get this word in. It takes discipline. I mean, people don't want to make
yeah.
the choice. And I'm not criticizing anybody, but when I'm coaching people or when I'm speaking, it's like, okay, like, it takes discipline, guys. I mean, that is such a key. And discipline is just like teaching. That's the word. It's a root word. And many great mentors understand that it takes a ritual. So what I did was a little boy, and it really was little, and it started early. I'm going to say second, third grade. And why I did this, I can't tell you. But in all the houses we lived in, I always had a bed by a window. And some might say, wow, that must have been cold in the winter because we didn't live in state-of-the-art houses. But I loved it. And I'd always put my head on the windowsill no matter what happened that day. And especially after we landed when I was in fifth grade, the second time in fifth grade, we landed in Dover, New Jersey, where we just spent with my mother, who's 88. I always, you know, point out to my daughters, this is the windowsill that saved my life, girls. And I had many other windowsills before I came here. Yeah, and I put it actually in my PowerPoint. I have a picture of it. And what I would do, no matter what happened, no matter if someone got beat, my father held 52 jobs in his life, so that means there were lots of Fridays. He either came home with no paycheck, he drank it away, or with a pink slip that he told someone off or got fired or whatever. If I got beat up, or if I got negative emotion from him, emotional abuse from him in, you know, you stink, you're not a great athlete, whatever it was, my head would go on that windowsill. And I would visualize. I had no idea what visualization was. But it was a precursor to me doing this work because I always woke up in a happier mood. What would I visualize? That I wouldn't be poor. I visualized I would get an education. There was no model for that in my family. My model was my peers. There were people who looked smart, and I had friends who, you know, paid attention in school. And so I modeled I would, you know, play college basketball. I visualized that I would have a scholarship because my parents couldn't pay. I visualized I would be a collegiate basketball coach. All of these things made me optimistic and made me feel like the next day, no matter what happened, I had the windowsill. Well, today in my life, it's getting up at whatever time I need to get up. And like this morning, I woke up at 4 o'clock. I don't wake up at 4 o'clock every morning, but never really much past 5. And when I was writing the books, it was at 3. But 4 o'clock, so why? Well, you know, to me, God kind of pushed me out of bed and said, you know, you need to do some ritual work. You need to get in here. And I do this every morning, but you know, a little extra, I guess, this morning. So I do intentional appreciation, and it's in the book. I breathe into my heart. I bring things that I appreciate, I'm grateful for. I mean, this economy, as you know, and I'm, you know, a speaker like me is the first to go in a lot of places. There are a lot of speaking engagements that were regular staples for me that are no longer available, or people don't have the money, or they want me to take a third of what they took, what they used to pay me. So I engage in these rituals with discipline to go into my heart. Or I will, if it's a deep healing, I will visualize my little boy. And as an adult, I will, you know, ask permission for my little boy to stroke his head or to hold his hand, little Kevy, I call him. Or if I'm scared, or so I'm not immune from the everyday things, the up and downs of being like Kevin Tuohy Incorporated, for no matter what I call the company, for 20 years it's been me, and all the pitfalls and all the joys that come from that. But I use joyful things. I have a bag of things that I appreciate. And what I mean by that is I'll tear off a little piece of paper and I'll write down something that happened to me that I appreciate. And it could be I remember one time Serena, my youngest daughter, who's 10, I remember when she was about 4 or 3, sitting outside here in my yard, and she discovered this worm, and it was amazing to me. This is how simple it is, really. It was amazing to me that she stared at this thing for a half hour, like, what is so interesting? And it fascinated me, and I wrote that on my piece of paper. So I might go downstairs at 4 in the morning, and I lost the Fox Entertainment contract that I had to give a $20,000 speech that's no longer available to me, and how I change my mood, not the condition's not changing first, I'm changing inside first. I'll reach into that bag to remind myself of all the great things I have in my life, and I might pull out Serena looking at a worm. And so I go to my heart, and right, I appreciate that, and I have gratitude about it. And it changes the way I'm looking at things. It physiologically, yes. I'm a psychophysicist. It changes the way I'm looking at things so that I can then make the calls to, I don't know, Aflac or Notre Dame or, you know, all the places that I solicit, you know, to bring Kevin Tuohy on board to do a workshop. And so it's a long answer, but people, if I can encourage them to do anything. And here's the other thing about the book. I'm nothing special. I mean, the book, I say that all the time when I speak. I mean, this stuff is practical. I used to do a workshop called the practical nature of ordinary miracles. I mean, there's a real practical nature of making yourself optimistic, and it's a ritual around things that you appreciate and breathing that into your heart.
Right. It comes down to simply you know, having that gratitude, having that appreciation. But I'll tell you, it is something to be reminded. And rituals, you know, creating your own rituals, connecting with rituals, it is a powerful tool to use in regard to keeping yourself on track and on purpose. One statement you made in your book that I absolutely love. There's many statements, but this is one that I think is poignant for this topic anyway. You wrote, "Your perspective determines the feeling state and the type of energy you will use to process any situation. Your perspective determines whether that energy in motion will be positive or negative." And this is how I live. I mean, this is a beautiful, in a nutshell, summarization of, you know, really how to go through your days, because it is all about taking your practical application of life, your, you know, changing the litter box, taking the garbage out, and having gratitude for the simplicity of being able to, you know, function and take care of the menial tasks as well as these sole purpose tasks, you know, and missions and guides. And so you really get into the gut and the heart and the soul, and of course that's where I live. So I really resonated with that.
Yeah, I know that you do.
You know, and I thought, you know, I read your book, and I thought, okay, we both were raised Irish Catholic. We both come from big families. You're one of 10. I'm the youngest of 6. I related to that. Our childhoods, however, were different, but that bond that you have within the family unit and that innate faith, that right or wrong of organized religion, it's there. And it's there as, you know, an inherent seed, but also sprouting new little, you know, arms and leaves and twigs of where that faith goes and how you move forward in helping others. And, I mean, you've taken a situation that, by all means, you could have ended up in an institution or in jail, or you know, you could have definitely fallen through the cracks, you know, having 8 different homes by 10 and, you know, all of these different things and a pretty emotionally unstable, you know, parental figure there, you know, for what he was going through and whatever he was having to deal with and his emotions and his fears. You know, you're a success story, and you say you're humble in your statement of you're not special, but you're special in regard to hearing your call and honoring it. And that, yes, is a miracle, because miracles happen every day, and we can bypass opportunities every day as well. You didn't.
Yes. No, that is true. You know, I do believe that. That I made a choice. I do believe this, that I made a choice. That, what I mean by not special is, see, everybody has free will and everybody can make a choice. So I do believe I made a choice, and I know this. And I knew it very early on. I wasn't going to let this defeat me. You know, that I knew.
Right.
And I also know what you just said, that, you know, I think I forget who it was that told my family once. I think it was a psychologist that told my brother and I that only about 2% of human beings, you know, that grew up like we, not just with, because it was such a 3-ring thing, meaning the poverty alone would have been restrictive, but with the emotional and physical abuse on top of it, that, you know, institutionalized debt early. There's been addiction in my family, but that's also a miracle. I have, you know, there's no active addicted. I mean, I have brothers with 30 years sobriety, 3 of them with over 30 years. I mean, all of it's a miracle.
Wow.
You know, and
yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. So I think our family, I think somehow it was important to me that people knew this story, and that somehow we were, you know, the hand of God for me is on our family, and that's not a religious statement. It's a statement that whatever created the universe, you know, had the hand on the whatever level of recovery has happened in my family. I think the gratitude piece that you said is such a key. Here's what I mean by that. If you had a $2,000 speech for 10 years, like many of the ones that I had on a regular speaking basis, and now because of budget cuts in school, see, and I love young people, so, you know, and they love me, and they love me because they know I love them, and they love me because I trust them, and they love me because I'm real, and they love me because I cut to the chase, I don't mess around with them. But here's the deal: a lot of that programming has been cut out. However, say that you had one school, and it was used to be a $2,000 speech, and now it's a $500 speech. How you look at that, why your perspective is so important, or my perspective, I'll speak for myself, is I immediately, because I know what's going to creep in, if I don't immediately establish a ritual of gratitude around in this economic crunch, someone is still going to write me a $500 check. Versus, how am I going to make up this $1,500? Oh, my God. I'm not saying I haven't slipped into that when it, you know, happens for the ninth time and you have a, you know, a certain way to live. And, I mean, I don't live high on the hog, but my mortgage company is interested in a payment every once in a while. You know, they want one to come through, you know. But what's your perspective? You know, how do you look at it? And I
right.
choose, see, I choose that in the morning in my ritual, and sometimes reluctantly, I choose to be grateful for the $500 and send some compassion for the people who've had to cut me completely, who love what I do. And so it's not that I'm living over here flat floating on a cloud. I have, you know, I have a lot of richness in my life because I attach myself to the process of what I do. And I do that every minute of day, but let's just use a 24-hour period of time. I just don't get in the perspective of, whoa, what am I going to do by the 30th of the month? Well, it's not the 30th, you know, and is this high
right.
school ever going to come back, and will Fox Entertainment ever again run a national convention where they have me back? You know, people's perspective and how they look at things. And I'm going to tell you, Lisa, in my workshops, especially adult workshops, people fight me on that thing that I just said, everything I just said, tooth and nail. I'll get through that whole thing and I'll say, yeah, okay, yeah, but, you know,
right.
and so use that word but and get it out of there, you know. Perspective
right.
is very important. You got to be grateful for what's coming your way if you expect more to come your way. And you don't be grateful just because you expect. You be grateful because it feels good. You know, gratitude
right.
physiologically releases hormones in your system that feel good.
That's right. And for the pessimist who may have struggle or difficulty identifying what they're grateful for, think about the things that you would really miss or be really hurtful if you lost them. And then take your gratitude from those aspects. You know, usually, hopefully, it starts with loved ones. And hopefully it
yes.
then starts with, you know, yourself and what you bring to the table and what you can provide. And there's a tremendous amount of people who really I'm finding, which is a little surprising to me, actually more than a little surprising, that people need, you know, instruction on how to get from point A to point B just in attitude and just in perspective. And, you know, I guess it's difficult for someone who does, you know, tend to look at things optimistically to understand that piece, but it's a very real piece, and it comes from a lot of pain in the past. It comes from trauma. It comes from, you know, stress. It comes from just all of those negatives compiled and piling up in the psyche that it's kind of hard to kind of get out from under. And so for anyone who recognizes themselves as a pessimist out there, you can start with really having gratitude and appreciation for the simpler things of life and the, you know, the
yes.
true heartfelt emotional things that make you buzz and make you tick through your day. We have about a minute left of our show, Kevin. So what would
oh my
you
goodness.
Like to convey to our audience? What would you like to, you know, get across that you feel like they could really benefit from in regard to maintaining optimism?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that one thing, and this would benefit both of us, is, you know, go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble and get the Miracle of Optimism. But, you know, I think it's a worthwhile book to help. But in the simplest form, I think that, you know, people just knew they were worth. People just say, you know, I'm worth feeling happier. I'm worth feeling good. I am going to establish rituals. You know, and the other thing I think that people need to empower themselves to let themselves know that they have a choice. And the choice is simple. Really, the choice is simple. So you'll find the methods if you make the simple choice of, you know what, I want to be happy. I want to look at things differently. Okay, so there's a simple
yes.
choice. And then the methods with which to do that can be simple too. Looking, you know, going to your heart, feeling appreciation for the littlest things, a worm, a girl looking at
That's
a worm.
That's right.
You know.
That's right. And we've got eight seconds. I want everyone to go out and buy The Miracle of Optimism. Kevin Toohey, Touhey is his last name. It's at Amazon.com. It's also on my Blog Talk Radio website. Kevin, thank you so much for being on our show. I really, really appreciate it. This was a wonderful, wonderful half hour to inform the listeners. And thank you so much. And we'll talk about your next book on another time.
Well, thank you very much, Lisa, for having me.
Thank you, Kevin. Have a great day.
You
thank
too.
You for joining us on Unlimited Realities, and have a blessed day.